doctor, if they have a therapist, they have medication, that's all appropriate. It would be lovely, lovely if you could get a release of information so you could be in communication with their therapist, you know, if they'll let you, because that's the best. Sometimes.
Okay, but as far as inviting them to your house for Shabbos, would that be like breaking down a wall then for somebody, and that would not be a healthy situation?
I think I'd be very careful before I do, because you may get yourself into a situation that, remember, it's not just you, it's your whole family, and you have to be fair to your family also.
Coming for any of those things?
No. No, I don't think you should discriminate against someone's mental health. I think you should have an awareness of it. So if somebody is having
someone has anxiety attacks, they're not dangerous.
No, no. Lots of us here have anxiety attacks. 70% of the population is having panic attacks now and then. You know, I wouldn't not invite someone with bipolar disorder either. I would just be aware of it. That would not, if, you know, here's an audience of women who are doing chemo. If I was on a college campus and somebody was manic, and they were having hyper-religious visions, that's probably not the right time to like bring them on board, because they're not engaging in a rational way, you know? So I don't think it's the proper time to do that. But I don't, you know, a lot of times you don't have a safety issue. It's more, the borderline is more about the boundaries.
Okay, my question is, I could write a book about mental health issues that we've had over the years, but let's say a person, let's say I recognize, and I've learned over the years to have good boundaries, and I recognize that this person needs assistance. What I've found is it goes hand in hand. Sometimes they don't want that help. So I'd just be interested to hear your take on that. If a person doesn't want to go to get the help that they need, whether it's a little bit of help or a lot of help.
It's very hard, right? You can't force somebody to treatment unless they're a danger to themselves or others. But you can gently encourage, you can recommend. I was telling someone before the seminar, if you want to recommend a therapist, by the way, I don't mind being recorded, but I'd rather not have this like released on the internet.
We have to just leave because of our shuttle bag. Can we lift a bracelet?
During the cast, can I just ask a question? I have a student that has OCD where she's like always like, I can't explain it. She can't touch. She's 20.
She is not going to get better without treatment.
But her parents are both psychologists, like, and she lives at home, so they must know, right? I never had a conversation, but I looked up to my husband.
Well, OCD
it bothers
is a very
me so much.
Illness.
She bothers me, though. Like, she's in my paper goods. She, like, has to have the food first. She's always, like, in my kitchen because she doesn't want anybody to touch the food. And, you know, right. We're having, like, 30 people for Shabbos.
She's a germaphobe also.
I don't know. It bothers me so much, and I feel bad because I looked at my husband, and I'm like, I just can't have her. My husband looks at me and goes, you know where she would be if she wasn't at her Shabbos table? I said, and he goes, in a mental hospital. And I was like, so I don't want to hurt my stomach.
Okay, well, first of all, most people with OCD do not end up in a mental hospital.
Right, I know.
It's a very hard illness. I will say it does not get better without treatment, but people with OCD are very good about hiding it. It's a very secret illness. So you might have someone who checks 15 times that they lock the door, but they wait to check it until no one's looking. Or you might have someone who has a cat. So it's possible
that
her parents don't know.
Oh, really?
It is possible. I mean, I'd be surprised, but, you know, or that they laugh about it. You know, they just see it as like a little quirky thing or whatever. But I don't think, I don't know what your relationship is with her. If you said something to her directly, she might be embarrassed and mortified.
Yeah, I feel like, I didn't even notice if there was anything wrong with her until I did. I was like, oh my gosh.
Well, mild OCD is livable. And if it's, right now it's annoying you, it's not annoying her, right?
I would think, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why it even annoys me, I just find it.
Like, well, it's your stuff. If she needs to, like I said, at some point she'll seek treatment. You don't have the same confidentiality thing that I have. Like, if I have a patient, I can't really call their parents and say anything. But I don't know how she would feel if you called her parents and said, you know, I think your daughter has OCD.
Yeah.
So it's a delicate relationship, but it's not, OCD is usually not life-threatening. Now, there are some people who their OCD is so severe they just can't manage anymore. But
does it get worse and worse?
OCD? It really can wax and wane. So people have periods. OCD is really a manifestation of anxiety. And so as times in their life when their anxiety is better or worse, their OCD will be better or worse. So they may some years be checked. And also OCDs can switch. So they may be a checker for weeks and weeks and weeks. They're checking if they turned off the oven. And then all of a sudden, they're not worried about turning off the oven anymore, but they're hand washing. And it will switch. When people seek treatment is when it really gets in the way of their function, which means probably takes up more than an hour and a half a day of their time. That's when people start to seek treatment.
Just my experience with either anxiety or OCD is that you're going to have to talk to that at some time or another, because somebody with these tendencies is not a candidate to start keeping mitzvahs, because right. it's going to exacerbate all of their, you know, behaviors and their inner stress. And I mean, if there's a way to do it, which I'm not good at, but like my husband's had conversations where it's like a floodgate. It's like, oh, it's such a relief that, oh, you mean, in other words, like being pushed sometimes by someone who sees your potential, but you need to get treatment can be, you know, welcoming.
That is what the studies show. I think that's a very good point. It just depends on how good your relationship is and how bad her OCD is. If it's mild and you bring it up, it may just like mortify her, because like I said, people are pretty secretive about it. But I think many times when you bring up to someone, I think you need to see a therapist.
I don't see anything on the board about like narcissism. I feel like we've had people who resist treatment, but sometimes they are going to alienate other people who are at the Shabbos table with their manner of speech. They're like, I know it all. If they're not getting treatment, I mean, is it the proper thing to do? It's kind of just like explain to them that you can't really, can't be here because you're...
Or give them cues about what they can and can't do.
Yeah, but they don't like to be told what to do.
Narcissists don't like to be told what to do.
But you know something? Something that I used to do when my husband was an NCSY for many years is that when we had people at our table, we had mostly teenagers, I would make it a point to talk about Shabbos table etiquette.
Yeah.
Shabbos table etiquette. There is such a thing as Shabbos table etiquette, which many, many people do not know, and especially people who are first becoming frum. There are certain things that you do at a Shabbos table and certain things you do not do when you come into somebody else's home. And do it by doing that, and you have to decide what, to a certain extent, what the Shabbos table etiquette is in your home. But if you talk to a group of people about Shabbos table etiquette, the other people will pick it up, and you will have set certain parameters for your home for everybody. So you're not directing it specifically at somebody, but people will begin to understand that this is proper behavior in this
situation. I find most of this stuff happens either like when they leave the Shabbos, or they're all going to stay at the house, you know, for the night. They're playing the game late at night, and this guy is just like, everyone starts complaining to us, like, you don't like this guy, or, you know, it could be at a barbecue. So, like, it's just the way they're very confrontational, the way they talk about themselves, the way they, you know, and the problem is when they've been coming around for years, even if they've never made an iota of change, people perceive them as, wow, like, they know everything, because they've been around for a long time, they're reading from the book, and after all, you know, they sure sound like they know what they're doing. It's like very dangerous, I feel like, you know.
Probably on a case-by-case basis, you know. I will say that I'm a big advocate for therapy, but narcissism is hard to change even with therapy. That's what all the research shows.
Really?
Yeah, it's not the most responsive.
I mean, just in our case, like, the guy went twice, and he's like, he had feeling that the therapist person wasn't worthy, which he wouldn't even submit to him. So I shouldn't feel so bad.
Well, can you tell me what city you're in?
Boca.
I can look if I have any clients who are with therapists.
Before, I understand how you were describing borderline, but is there a milder flavor of that,
yeah,
where the person doesn't press you or dump you, but they do try, like, it's never enough? Is there a milder flavor that's still, like, you know,
children
in the basket?
Is it children?
Yeah, but it's not really a joke, because emotionally they're like 10-year-olds.
Right. There's a difference between a disorder and a trait. You know, so if you have certain characteristics, you have the traits. When it becomes a full-blown disorder, it's when it interferes with your social, occupational, relationship functioning. I mean, there's a lot of people in our lives that could always want more and could always take more. But, you know, the well can only give water as long as the well doesn't run dry. So if someone's sucking every single bit out of you, you need to be able to refill yourself and take care of yourself. And with those milder cases, that's what you have to do. Set some limits so that you can take care and nurture yourself. And I don't know. So short of time, if you want to talk about taking care of yourself, or we should continue talking about that.
Well, I think this is very relevant to what they're dealing with. So,
what would you tell them? I just want to say about what you're saying, that if there's somebody at the table that people don't feel comfortable with, for whatever reason, sometimes we've had people who are just like a little off, a little socially awkward. For whatever reason, if there's one person that's making people uncomfortable, we kick them out. I mean, gently, whatever. We've had this several times, and once it's been a relative of one of them, the caravan. Can you imagine how awkward that was? Because the problem is that people won't come to your table if they anticipate being, you know, cornered by this talking person.
Yeah, we'll just send them by themselves somewhere to, like, another family in the community. And then no hors d'oeuvres.
What I'm saying is that you don't have to feel bad. Like, look, it's
not this person that you come
from. It's not your problem. You know what I mean? The whole triage thing.
Well, we're going to be careful about not hurting your feelings, you know?
No, of course you have to be careful about your feelings. But your responsibility is to the group. You can't sacrifice.
No, I agree 100%.
It's two people from philosophy.
I was wondering if anyone had experiences. I've had guided girls who very much want to become firm for very wrong reasons, and many of the reasons have to do with mental health issues. And clearly, we don't put all of our energy into that one kid because I know that the reasons aren't healthy, and we sent them to therapy and all the rest, but there's this push to like want to become firm because that's going to like cure their issues, which are really mental health issues. So like, for instance, we had a student who was sexually abused by her father, and if she could become from, then she could dress as Nias, then she could avoid men, not touch men, not be near them, not marry them, and she could just like avoid the whole male gender, and that was like her cure for her very large issue, which we sent her to therapy for, and she became from, and went to tons of therapy, got married, you know, after the Yichurim, the wedding was like over, you know, because she like crashed and couldn't handle it, and I saw this coming years ago, and it was very sad. We tried very much to help her. You know, she would not slow down becoming from it for anybody. She just, this is what she wanted, and it was coming for very unhealthy reasons. I was wondering if, you know, other people maybe had experiences with that.
Well, it sounds like you did the right thing sending her to therapy, and I think you're right. You can't use therapy as a protection from, I mean, religion as a protection from your demons. You have to face them, and it sounds like she didn't, and it's sometimes hard to, you can't take all the responsibility yourself, but you tried. You sent her to therapy.
Years. She's been therapy for years.
I think this is something so common. I think we face this a lot with students who are trying to skip that step of working on their emotional health before and just become vulnerable. So we always advocate them for therapy, but I think I'm always looking for more reasons.
Yeah, what might be helpful is to have a relationship with the therapist. Like, in other words, have therapists that you know and trust and that understand and can help them pace themselves. Like, even myself as a psychiatrist, like I have certain therapists I know I can work with and some that I know that I can't. I want to have someone who's supportive. If a woman is trying to work through, and by the way, one of the risks that, when I talk about an emotionally invalidating environment creating borderline personality disorder, the ultimate emotionally invalidation is sexual abuse in the home. So, you know, these are the stories that you hear all the time. The girl comes to her mom and says, Mommy, 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 so-and-so hurt me, and her daddy, stepfather, whatever, shut up, I don't want to ever hear you say such a terrible thing again. We talk about the invalidation that occurs, and that is part of what creates that borderline personality disorder, which then seeks out some religion that will allow them to hide, but it's not a religion to hide behind, it's to live by. So if you have therapists who understand that, that you can refer them to, that you have a relationship with, I think that looks much better than just like whoever might be on their choice.
So we just started at where we are right now at Penn State, and in like the few weeks that I've been there, like the girl that I just met with, I've been meeting with her, and it just came out on like our last meeting that she was molested and her parents didn't believe her. Anyways, she like on her own is like now going to go and seek out counseling, which I was like, was going to be the next word out of my mouth, because I'm like, I'm not obviously equipped to obviously solve this thing for her, because she doesn't, then it's like what you're saying, she's does no interest, she has totally no problem with Shomer Nagia, because she doesn't want to be touched at all. A side note though, so she's going to go to the counselor. How can I kind of like broach it, but like to be involved in this in counseling? Like, should I ask her for the number? Should I reach out?
Do you think she would like you to be involved?
I think so.
Can I say, listen, I understand. I'm so happy that you decided to get some therapy. I feel so honored that you trusted me with this. I think I can help you best if I'm able to have some communication with you, because I can only do that with your written permission. And then she has a choice, but I would not, even though you are not under the state HIPAA laws, certainly the therapist is, and you really can't have a communication without written permission.
But after the permission, then I can be in communication.
Yeah, I guess I would fax a copy of the written permission to them.
Okay. I just see a lot of girls with low self-esteem, so I don't know if you, as a therapist, is there things that we could do? Like, I understand, like, I've heard tips of building up your own children's self-esteem, but, like, as, you know, having people over, you know, for Shabbos or doing classes, how would you recommend that we help build up girls' self-esteem if we see that they're having self-esteem issues?
I think that you build self-esteem best by giving people opportunities to do things they do well.
To
do things they do well. So if you have a young woman who doesn't feel confident,
you know, does she dance, does she sing, does she bake, does she write, what does she do, and then help her get engaged and involved. I do like this, I don't like the name, but I like the workbook, 10 Days to Self-Esteem. The reason I don't like the name is that here you have these people with poor self-esteem. They say, 10 Days to Self-Esteem, it's been 11 days, I'm not fixed yet, oh my God, I'm really a failure. So the name really is not great, but the workbook is a really nice workbook to recommend to people to start working through. I find most of my patients who use it on college campuses tear off the covers so their friends don't know what they're working on.
I just wanted to say something about girls becoming prone for, like, the wrong reasons, basically. And I don't have the answer, but I think to a certain extent, maybe a very small extent, we actually do have a little bit to put toward this, meaning there's a lot of girls who really think, if I'm prone, my life will be perfect. Why? Because probably all of your houses and your lives look perfect. So when a girl came to me and said, I fought with my husband, and she's devastated, and she said to me, I've never seen you and Rabbi Winter fight, I was like, oh boy, the next time I have a cat and dog, I'll have to do it in front of you. But these girls, Baruch Hashem, I don't have that problem. But the girls really think, like, that's what your life looks like to me, and that's what I want, so I'm going to do what you did. But they have no idea what goes on behind the scenes. I'm not suggesting that we all start fighting in front of the girls or, like, freak out at our kids, but we do have to be real with them. If not even by visual, like, explain to them our struggles and that we're also normal. And it should be real, because there's tons and tons of girls who go through this and they're like, but this isn't what I signed up for. But it's real. But we just have to make sure that we're letting them see what's real.
Absolutely. But the two things I wanted to mention. One is that there's this idea that we're all trying to increase our numbers. I'm just going to put this out there. And a lot of times people that struggle with mental illness are the low-hanging fruit. They're the ones that we could get them to the trip because they really need that attention, that we could get them on, you know, to fill our home base numbers, we could use that. And it's a very dangerous thing to do, I think, and we have to be very careful of that and very mindful that we really are doing what's best for the student and best for, you know, everyone, and not what's best for us. So that's
okay. Absolutely. Okay,
well. I have a question. In your professional experience, if you're getting to know somebody, how many conversations of sort of like emotional, private one-on-ones before a person comes back to the same issue? Do you realize that they're not interested in growing, they're interested in you as a substitution for their medicine or for their therapy? Not that I've ever been in that. All of us. Cabinet, so a lot of people.
Hypothetically. That's a very fair question.
I'm closed, officially, yes. But they don't know that.
I mean, that's the danger, that's what we're really addressing. And when you feel they're using you as their therapist, I think that's time to refer. I don't think you should be there.
But is there like a general like
warning sign?
No, or like is there a certain amount, like is it professional, in your professional experience, how many sessions, like, I'm not a therapist, but how many hours is somebody sort of fixating on sort of same thing and not wanting to look at it differently, would you say like,
like at what point does it cross over from venting and having a listening ear and really needing help?
I think when you feel it, you're like, okay, I've heard this four times.
Because this is 5 minutes into a conversation. Fair for that person.
Well, you
just be like, you know, this is what they said, that my dad, you don't want to go like therapy.
For us to know exactly where the spectrum
is. Okay, so everything is a spectrum. You can think it after 5 minutes. I do think that most people would be really insulted. If right. After 5 minutes, you say, you need a therapist. So you can that opinion in your mind. I mean, I can say, because I am a therapist already there, they know that, but if you form that opinion in your mind after 5 minutes, I would wait a
while. So, 2 more minutes.
I would wait, unless I thought they were in imminent danger, I would wait a couple more times before I approach it. Because if you say it after 5 minutes, they're not going to buy
you.
You
have
trust.
No, but
they
don't have to trust you. I have trust you, but at the same time, it's just like,
I mean, and you can also say, this sounds like so much more than I'm equipped to handle. Here's someone who could help you with this. as a, you know, saying you've taken the eye on yourself rather than you need a therapist. I don't feel adequately equipped to handle this, that you're not putting the blame.
The other thing is that I think it's really an important thing to help people understand that going to therapy is not a weakness, and it's not a sign that they're doomed forever. That the truth is, everybody needs a therapist sometime or other in their life. Everybody needs, just like, you know, there's a new saying my husband told me, amongst Madison Avenue, everybody needs a rabbi. This is non-Jews who are saying this.
Wow.
There is a you have to help people. Most people still, as far as we've gone, there's still a huge stigma to mental health, to helping people with mental health issues. One of the best things you can do for somebody is make them realize that this does not in no way denigrates them, in no way. As a matter of fact, it's a strength. It's a strength if you go for help. You will change your life. You will become a much more functional, happy person. There's so many benefits, and you will also be able to help other people as well. You have to help people really, because people resist going to therapy because they feel that there's a stigma, and we ourselves have got to be in the right place as far as that's concerned, because you have to ask yourself, if I have an issue, will I go for help? And if you're not ready to go for help, then you have to be very hesitant about telling somebody else, because people read it loud and clear. So you have to be in touch with yourself, which is, I think, a bottom line in almost all of Kira work or work in dealing with people, is the first thing that we all need to do is to be in touch with where we stand and how we feel about anything that's happening in our lives. And once you do that and you work through some of those issues yourself, then you can help take people to the next step.
See why I said she's so wise? But I want to add, it depends what city you're in. Like in New York, L.A., just like that, it's a status symbol to have a therapist. Take like Baltimore, people are not quite as cool with it. But, you know, self-exploration can be a really healthy thing. I think, so take the one-day opposition. I can't help you with this, but here's someone who can. I can't emphasize enough how good it is to have a set of resources. There are a few cities that have programs like Relief, where you can just call them and they will advise you who's a good therapist for us. And take advantage of that if you're in a city that has that.
We had a student who very quickly went through like a pretty severe episode. I think it was bipolar. He wasn't really sure. And then we sent him to a therapist, and we caught him when he was like suicidal already. He was in being watched in a hospital. And then I guess he went somewhere, like, you know, a different state, and he got things together and he got on medication. And then he came back a year later. He had gained like 50 pounds from the medication, and he stopped it. And he started coming around again, and I was saying to my husband, like, I think we need to a little bit use our leverage like a threat. Like, you need to be on your medication. This is, you know, every time you have another episode, it's going to kindle your disease to be even worse the next time. Right. And I feel like, so, but then when we did that, he just started getting involved in, like, very bad things. And it's like, how much do you, I don't know if they were listening to you anyway, how much do you help, like, use it over them? Like, well, you can't be part of this before you take care of your health.
I think it's good to set a phone number like that. What do you think?
It's good to go to what?
Someone who has a severe mental illness who was suicidal and is not taking their medication, I could set a limit, like, to work with you.
But they're just leaving and going to explore other bad areas. It's not like they're getting threatened by it. So should we welcome them in anyway now, or just, like,
a suggestion. Maybe say, like, my home is always open for you. You know, just like if a kid is off the dental professional or something similar. But not, like, to big events, not anything that, you know, if we have limited 20 spots, you're not going to be one of the spots.
Well, it's not a reflection. There's nothing wrong with the person. They're not dangerous. They're fine now, but
right.
Want
to
be proactive.
You're saying you want them to still come to you.
So you're not concerned.
That's pretty offensive if you say you're not one of the 20 spots. And to me, that's like, don't come around. We don't really care about you.
I see the difference in that.
You're not concerned that he's suicidal.
So now he's fine, but it's just going to be a matter of time until he falls out. Yeah. I mean, I invested a lot in personally sharing things that, you know, from other people I've seen, and now it's just like he's all fine and dandy, but I see, you know, I don't want him coming again when he's suicidal for his sake.
But you've had situations sometimes really that does happen, and then what I say to students is, I care too much about you. You know, I care about your well-being, I care deeply about you, and I can't enable you to continue doing this. And by me ignoring the fact that, you know, your mental health is going down the tube over here, I'm enabling your behavior, and I just can't, I care way too much about you to allow that. And that usually does either propel them to stop coming, or usually it does propel them to get the help that they need. I'm not rejecting them, I'm just making it very clear that I can't be a part of their downward spiral. I can't play a role in that and just pretend that like nothing's happening.
But it sounds a little selfish then, like, but what do you commit if I'm still not going to take care of myself and I'm just not in your sight, then it's okay? Like, what hurts you to see it personally? It's a little bit...
Well, I don't think you want to enable them. Right,
say, like, you know, right, but say, if you're not doing that, it's not going to help them. It's not going to motivate them. So should you really do that just to kind of... It's not a threat if you don't keep it, I guess.
Think of a threat support
you decide what limit you need to set with that person, depending on, again, on the individual.
Well, I have two questions. I love what you said about how if you believe that there is a weakness, they don't see it. Do you think it's appropriate to share with them that you spend time with therapy, or is that a lack of boundary?
What do you think?
I don't. I guess as a therapist, I'm very not used to self-disclosure. So I'll do things like Yahweh, the welfare psychiatrist, is therapeutic translucency. So you'll share something if it's in the benefit of the patient rather than share something that's for your benefit. So I certainly wouldn't share, like, oh yeah, my father was abusive also, and then, like, you know, when it's cost trouble, whatever, something like that. But if you felt that in this situation, you know, many people go to therapy for a issue during a brief time in their life. I know many people have done that. I think that might be better than saying, I've been therapy.
No, for sure. But let's say, for instance, you know they think very highly of you, and you see that when you suggest that therapy, they're insulted, and they'll say things like, I'm not always, like, this upset. I'm this upset when I'm with you. Like, basically, you think I'm crazy.
Right.
So to say something like, oh, no, I think really impressive people go to therapy, you know, and then to go on and say, like, I think there's no ultimate proof to show them how impressed you are.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I do sometimes in a situation. I do stay away from self-disclosure, you know. But I would tell them something like, they don't know my sister. And I would tell them, my sister went to therapy also because she really blah, 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 my sister.
Right, that's true.
So, and I have six sisters. So, so I'm saying, like, you know, that's my thing, but you can find another that type. But I feel like that makes a difference to them. And then I don't change myself for their eyes at all anyway. But...
But if we're sincerely saying there's no stigma in therapy, then what's wrong with saying,
right,
I also went to therapy?
What's the question? And they see who you've become and how far you've come.
Funny stories.
Is that, I mean, why is that so too much like self-challenges?
No, you have
like
to
you
really,
the example
of I really think that in all of these cases, you have to use your judgment. You really have to use your judgment, and you have to rely on your intuition. Most of us distrust our intuition, but the truth is your intuition will lead you usually to do the correct thing. If you feel that this person will gain by my having said something, again, you have to be careful about how much you say. But I have told people who have come to my house that I am a tremendous believer in seeking therapy, and if I sense in my children, one of my children, that they can benefit from therapy at a given time, I run in that direction because I want my children to be healthy, solid people. And I think you can generalize this to other things as well. You have to be careful that, again, that you're not disclosing something that you will later say, why did I say that?
Or maybe that they would hold against you.
Right. So you have to be careful when you do it. But again, I think your intuition and your sensitivity to the situation can be a guidepost to what you're going to do.
You know, I was thinking, one of the things I would be careful about self-disclosure is you have such a lack of privacy already. Someone's in your house, they're there for your Shabbos table, they know your kids are there. I think you need a little bit of personal space that you have something, that it could be whatever it is, whether, you know, that you, that you have that privacy, that you have that boundary, because already there's so, there is so much interconnection, and I think that a little bit of a boundary is a helping thing.
Is the exact boundary, is that the, like, personal preference? Like, some people are much more open, some people are much more private.
Right. And I, you know, being in Kirov already says that you're an open person. You can have people in your home, and people observe you. You say about letting people see you fight, that you don't, or, that you don't always get along, or whatever. You know, that there's already, but that's why you need to preserve a certain amount. And where that lies may be different for different people, but, you know, I think that has to be something.
You know, I just want to say, like, some of the stories that some of the women are saying, they really kind of scare me, because the fact is, I think a lot of us stay in situations because we think, like, that we are able to help the other person, and we really can't help them. I'm in the middle of something right now, and as I'm listening to these descriptions, I'm pretty sure the woman is probably either, she's probably a borderline personality disorder. But what happened was, besides the cute thing, I have a gemach, and I help people clean up messes, and a lot of photos are a little on the nutty side, but this particular one, I was the only one that could help her in 35 years and whatever. Anyway, when she decided to turn around, I had a warrant out for my arrest in Cleveland, and actually I spent 4 hours in jail because my attorney told me to turn myself in Cleveland Heights, that's what you do, because they don't send you the warrant, they assume they'll pick you up for, like, a traffic violation in Cleveland Heights, and you're from a great place, Rabbi Klanska. And and what happened was, I mean, I got the number, the mugshot, I got the fingerprinted, the whole thing, I got a cell, the whole thing.
Why are we doubting that she was borderline?
What I'm just saying is, I don't think people, I'm still in the middle, like, I've done 2 pre-trials, and my third one is on December 17th. My kids call from Yeshiva to find out if I'm in jail or not. But I just want to say,
this is better than
I never thought that anything like this was going to hit me because I feel like I'm invincible. I mean, what can't I do? I can do anything. And unfortunately, it landed me in a slammer.
What I would say, a few things. Again, as I opened up, it is, but it's a little bit, we our admiration for the work that you're doing is unbelievable. You're amazing, you're fantastic, you're wonderful. But I also think that 45 minutes to an hour is hardly enough to touch on one of these topics, let alone all of them. So, but before I say that, I just want to say one more commercial because I'm a psychiatrist, I can't help but say, I hope I didn't do it, I try not to, but I try to say a person with borderline personality disorder as opposed to a borderline, or a person with bipolar disorder, because people are so much more than their illness or than their weather situation. So when you think about the person that you're working with, think about them as the whole person who also has X, Y, or Z. And if they have X, Y, or Z, don't try to treat yourself. You really should not. And like I said, all the literature shows that the best treatment for borderline personality disorder has to have more than one person involved in the treatment. And so I want to thank you for everything you do.
Thank you.
And absolutely to talk about this more.
Thank you so much. That's really important.
They're done. Thank you to you, both of you, for coming. But we're not done. Okay, we're going to close. Before we close, I'm just going to make one blue netter promise. I will send everybody, I hope, I think we have, first of all, contact sheets downstairs if you want to take lists of people who are here. But I'll anyway mail it out to everybody. I'm also going to mail you a survey that asks you more questions and maybe to write a paragraph about yourself so that I can mail that out so that everybody knows kind of what you do, what you're working on, what you're thinking about, so that people could know a little bit more about you since we didn't do that kind of networking here. Also, how to join the WIC list. There's a Yahoo listserv that we have for women in Kiruv, and we now have a WIC, W-I-C-K list. Really, WIC was Women in Chinuch in Kiruv. Dropped the C with the first conference, so it wouldn't be Torah Masorah, it would just be Women in Kiruv. And now we're adding the C back in for Women in Campus Kiruv! Right, so we have a Google WIC list and a Yahoo WIC list. So,
Lisa, what about putting up...
I'll send you the link for both. And I will also...
Recordings.
I'll post the record. I'll make a special page for this year's conference on my website and post that. We are working on a WIC website, but it's not there yet fully. But I'll send you the link for these year's classes, and or you can go on my website and you'll be able to just look up WIC and you'll find it, the page, because I have a search bar for my website, abideoftorah.com. What else did I want to tell you? That's the two listservs. Drop off your keys if you have keys. I think that's it. Wait, no, there is more. I just want to make sure the announcements are done before everybody leaves. But we want Rabbi Klasko is going to actually close for us. So I'll, before he finishes, just say thank you to everybody for coming. It's been so fabulous. Thank you to you guys for coming. I really appreciate it. Thank you to the Lowell Browns for allowing WIC to hatch under their roof at AJOC. We're grandchildren. I see ourselves as grandchildren. And thank you to the Klaskos. Is your wife here?
Yeah, Lisa, I'm right here.
Oh, great. So I just want to mention, everybody's talking about Rabbi Klasko, Rabbi Klasko, wow. The truth is, he has a wife. So we all know. We all know that behind every great man is a woman. Behind every great woman is a huge pile of laundry. So, and hopefully a supportive husband as well. But I don't think everybody knows that both of them, like, he's in wholesale Kiruv now, but they were both in retail Kiruv for a long time. I think you do some retail still also, right? But
I love those terms.
Retail's when you're on campus. Wholesale's is when you are, that's why, when I was asking my husband, I got these words from my husband, so I said, should I take a JWRP trip? He said, honey, he said, you're not in retail anymore. You're in wholesale. So there's a difference between, I mean, of course, we still have people at our shop table, but it's not the same as really being in front lines or working with people who are in front lines. So they do both. But his wife also, Shani, right, Mrs. Klasko, Rebson Klasko, was a campus powerhouse as well. So I don't know if you're available ever for phone calls or advising. Are you ever with people who would want to call you to ask advice? But we need as many mentors as we can get. So anyway, I want to thank you for paving the way for so many people. And without further ado, I'd like to invite Rabbi Klasko to close for us.
Thank you.
Only the strong survive. Aren't you like ramping it up after?
And I think that was
good.
I mean,
that's good.
You're going to get that.
The final wrap. Yeah. Okay, good. So first off, yes, thank you to Aliza. Aliza's a good friend. Many, many. For all the McCarvin, it's good to know that there is somebody out there, and I do mean out there in Denver, who is available for us. And the truth is, we have two children in Denver, so it's good to know that Aliza's there. We have a daughter there, a son goes to yeshiva there. I may have shortchanged Bela when I last spoke. I want to mention a conversation that I had with her before. I think it was the last conversation that I had with Bela Burnham before she was Nefteris. I had come down to Maryland to speak at the Maimonides, and she calls me into the kitchen in their little area over there, and she started speaking actually about getting therapy for the students. That was her big thing, to get them emotionally healthy, and she was very, very, very passionate about it. And what I took from what Baylor was saying is really a tremendous message to all McCarvim and their families and their spouses, which is that in a certain way we have to be a one-stop shop. It's really, really tough to hear this, because with the Wolfsons wanting their numbers, we're always trying to get the next crop of people and the next amount of people on trips, and we know there's AYs and SOs, and you heard Rabbi Cassell, and it's hard to really focus on the fact that when a person becomes from or on their way, they're going to need to get a job. They're going to have problems with shidduchim, perhaps. They're going to need help with their family. And what Bela was actually saying is that we have to become a whole service operation. And I believe in that. And she was right. And she had a tremendous devotion to towards her students. I once did a Ma'ar trip with her, and there was this one girl who never, she was sort of bipolar. She ended up having to leave in the middle of the trip. But Baylor really spent many, many hours with her, trying to guide her, and afterwards she kept up with her as well. And it takes a person who really gets it. And sometimes people go into Kiruv and they're sort of like a flash in the pan. They go, they're there for a few years, and then they go on to business or other chinuch, and it's all good and no one's judging. But it's interesting for myself, and I, you know, to add on to what Aliza just said. I don't know, how many people here have been in Kiruv less than 3 years? Can you raise your hand to find out? Wow, a lot of old-timers here, that's great. So, I don't know, if one day when the history of Kiruv on campus will be written, they will tell the story of the very first family that attempted to come on to Kiruv, not Chabad, but the first of the Eish, or Sameach, Machal Shlomo, and the very first family. And that first family was our family. We were the very first ones. And for me, that wasn't, I guess, such a big deal because, I mean, I had never been on to college, but I grew up in a very sort of open home, and my father is a doctor, and he went to college in Cincinnati, and we had a very open upbringing. My wife, on the other hand, grew up in Borough Park, 14th and 45th Street. She went to Beis Yaakov of Borough Park. Yes, the big Beis Yaakov of Borough Park. And the last person who you would expect to be a pioneer, to be the first person to sort of start this movement 15 years ago, would be the head of the Chesed committee in Beis Yaakov of Borough Park. And she's the first one onto campus. And we didn't come with one or two kids. When we first came, we started off with six kids. That was our start, was with six kids. And my wife and I,
even... How far were you from the community?
We were about a half an hour drive. 25 minutes, half an hour. Later on, we moved to the Valley. Last year and a half, we were there for 5.5 years. The last year and a half, we moved to the Valley. So we were in a community, but the community that we really were close with, which was Hancock Park, was now even further away. And my wife speaks fondly about her carpool days, and I do mean carpool days, because the whole days were carpool, and we just spoke about it a few days ago, and I told my wife, you know, instead of ruining that time, it's a great way to think about the schar, because nashim b'may zachin, what's their zchus? It's that they bring their kids. So what is zchus when you get to go and come your whole day long, you're doing mitzvahs? I hope that helped revise history. But Baylor was one of those people. She was also one of the founders of Kiruv. When Kiruv originally began, there were certain core families that began, again, in UCLA. Then Ellie Bloom and his wife joined. And then the Garfinkels came soon after. So you were really at the very beginning. You were within the first 4 or 5 years of this whole thing. You've been around for a long time. And I'm sorry. but there are people who have just seen it grow, and we went through expansion mode and then sort of retraction mode, and Rutgers was there and Maryland was there, and I remember Maryland right when it began, and the two rabbis who were there were doing it as volunteers, Rabbi Koretsky and Rabbi Burnham, and look how many people are from, look how many families have kindlech, and those kindlech are becoming bar mitzvah in some of them. And well, we have a family that we worked on that the girl had wanted to have nothing to do with me, and now they live in Baltimore, and they come each year on Purim with their kids all dressed up. They come to Muncie and just to say hello to our rabbi, who was like our Rimkav, him and her, and they met in our home. So this is the nachas that you're all in store for if you last long enough, and you already have seen this kind of nachas, and some of you've also been in it for a long, long time. Those who have been through the tough times. So I wanted to give my wife that credit, not just for being the power behind everything that I do, literally, As you know, you probably know she cooks for, you know, between 60 and 100 people a week. We still do a major Shabbaton each and every week. And so that's like still retail, still involved in retail. And she does it without complaining. And people, and we, she doesn't just feed them, but we actually have everyone sleep. So she has to find housing. Which she doesn't like. I know she doesn't like it, but it's part of it. And she makes three. Yeah, yes, we do. We use Shabbat.com for that. We use Shabbat.com, and we the more people we have signed up, the more hosts are available to use. And that's why it's important that we have good hosts. As a matter of fact, not last week we were away. The week before we had about 85 people. About 45 of them came through the website. And my wife puts them all up for sleeping and till a grand havdalah. So let's give it up for my wife. She's amazing. Yeah. I have a standing ovation. She doesn't like it, which is why I do it.
Domestic abuse right here.
Domestic abuse, that's right. That's right. Okay. How do we end with a bang? I think there's something that is critical to digest about life, and particularly about Kiruv. And I call that concept connect the dots. Connect the dots means as follows. If you remember the dot to dot that you played as a kid? It was like the easiest, the first puzzle. 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's called connecting the dots. Now, what would happen if they gave you a dot to dot or connect the dot, but they didn't number the dots? But you'd have a tough time. You know, you'd end up with like a ball of yarn. You wouldn't know where to go. The Almighty has amazing dots, and He has numbered those dots. And often, we don't understand how the dots connect, and it takes a while. And sometimes it takes a simcha. Sometimes it takes tragedy. Sometimes it takes a plane ride that you're sitting next to somebody and you connected. You connect the dots. I mean, we all have these stories. I mean, we could just go on and on how if A hadn't happened, then B, then C, then D, then E, then F, then G. And the greatest chizuk that I can give you to end this conference, and we're all coming away with different things, and some are coming away with peer and friendship and eitzes. The greatest chizuk I can give you is you don't have to see the whole picture right now. You don't. I have a radio show, and I was on this morning, and actually my guest is Rivka Malka, which was great because so many phone calls and messages to the radio station. Rivka Malka is very compelling, and in the show, someone asked a simple question. They said, "How do I know what my tafkid is?" It's very sort of a straightforward. How do I know what my tafkid is? And the Bali Musar say it's simple. You know how you know what your tafkid is? You know what your tafkid is? By what makes you happy. If something makes you happy, that's your tafkid. Except, the caveat to that is, you don't know how it's going to end. You didn't, how many of you knew that you were going to end up in Kiruv? One, two, okay. Not two. I didn't know I was a Rav in a shul for 10 years. I was a Rav. I had a beard. I taught Yoreh Deh and blah, blah, blah. Yes, yes. I didn't, and I taught in Berea, and I taught in Chaim Berlin, and Torah Das, and Prospect Park. That was my first 10 years of my life. I lived in Borough Park, and 3 years in Perth Amboy, New Jersey. When I went into Kiruv at the age of 30, I turned to my father, and I said, "You know, I'm thinking of going to UCLA to do Kiruv." And he said, "You sure Kiruv is for you?" That was his first words. He said, you sure? I never looked at you as a Makar. Those were his words. Like, and he was right. I never gave any indication. What happened? What happens? I went to what made me happy, and as time went on, my tafkid came into focus. That's something so beautiful to understand. You don't have to know the end game because you're a project. right? You're a work in progress. You're going to change, and as you change, your tafkid will become more and more clear to you. Mark Zuckerberg, who everyone knows from Facebook today, did he know he was making Facebook? No idea. He started with a website about comparing people, and that's how he started. Look at his biography. He had no idea that because of him, Tunisia and Egypt would be overthrown. Yeah, mad little Jewish kid in college. Hey, let's overthrow the prime minister of Egypt. Right? But that's exactly what he did. It's exactly what happened. It was through Facebook that they Tahrir Square, they called everyone together, bada bing, bada boom, Egypt was overthrown, and much has happened. Your tafkid comes into focus as you keep doing what you're happy doing. And that makes you feel good because you don't have to dwell at night. Am I doing my tafkid? Do I belong on campus? Maybe I should be doing something else? Or guys like me who were tortured with, should I be working with the kids at risk? Why am I working with these kids when I could be working with those kids? Right? My brother does that. Let's work. Right? No, you don't have to worry about just, are you happy doing what you're doing right now? And if you're not happy doing, speak to Aliza, she'll help you get happy. Speak to others, they'll help you figure out what's irking you, what's bothering you. And once you're happy doing what you're doing, your tafkid will come into focus, and then you'll know. And when you get it, you'll get it. It's going to feel so good. And guess what? Your tafkid may change as you get older and wiser, and you may go from the micro to the macro, and soon you'll be running a city. You'll be helping a city become firm. And then you'll be helping with shidduchim. And then you'll be helping with older singles. And then you'll be helping with kids at risk. And then disabled kids. You don't know where it's going to take you. As long as you have nachas, as long as you allow your dots to be connected. Just take it one dot at a time. That's how we do it. Yeah?
I'm just trying to really listen to what you're saying and make sure I understand. So you're really supposed to take your temperature at every, in all the decisions that you're making, say, am I enjoying this? Is this aligned with what you didn't say this, but what I'm good at, what I enjoy, what I naturally think about, what I find interesting. If it's not, then I'm oriented in the wrong direction. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, Kim Adat. You do have to take your temperature. There is such a thing as being too self-aware. That's also not good. Right? There is such a thing as being too self-aware, like, oh, am I feeling good at this moment? Don't be too self-aware because we're all in flux. You know, anyone, you know, I mentioned I'm on a diet, so one of the bad things about dieters is we love to step on the scale to see how much weight we lost every 10 minutes. Right? Right?
Sometimes it also takes time to be happy. Like, if you go to a place or if you're starting a thing and I say, okay, I'm not happy, so let's change it to a different idea.
Right. That's where becoming too self-aware, it becomes a problem, right? You have to start off. If you're writing a novel, you're not going to feel sipuk hanefesh after 3 pages. You have to allow it to sort of evolve. But once you're doing it, find out what makes you happy. And sometimes what you're doing is great and it's making you happy, but because you're not taking care of yourself, you're not happy. And you have to, you know, I've mentioned this, and I spoke at Arnava once a month, and I mentioned that in order for us to be happy, sometimes we have to know what our little taivas are and indulge in them. You gotta enjoy you like microwave popcorn, you like a hot bath, you like listen to music, or right? But whatever you like to indulge in those things, take care of yourself, because you don't want the little things to sabotage what you're doing, which is big, which would be giving you sipukah nefesh if you just had those little things to check. But in general, that's what I'm saying. You have to know what you're doing is making you happy. And it should make you happy. Sometimes you have to take a few steps back and appreciate the impact that you're making to make you happy. Right? When I mentioned to my wife, I mentioned on the way here that, by the way, this is momentous because my wife doesn't usually come to things like this. We have a lot of kids, Kanainahar, and a big house and Shabbos going on. And I don't have. Do we have to wrap this up? Yeah?
Some people are leaving now.
3:30? Okay, let's say it. So I told her, by the way, you're the founder of this. And this is not like just historically. The reality is that if we hadn't had Hatzlacha, then the next people wouldn't have had Hatzlacha. UCLA would have ended and Wolfson wouldn't have given it money. Wolfson, I mean, I could give you the whole history, but Wolfson came for a meeting, I think it was at your house. Is that your house, the Wolfson meeting?
Oh, in L.A.
In L.A. Yes. It was at your house that all...
At
your
dining room.
Thank you. It was at your house that this whole thing blew up, but it wouldn't have happened without you. So it's a matter of connecting the dots and see. I'm just going to end with one inspiring story, and after this story, you're free to go. I think you'll have enough from this. So I told a few of you, so if you've heard it, be Michael. But if you haven't, I think it'll make you smile. So. So we had a fire in the house. Some of you may know about that. We had a fire in the house, and this was 7 years ago. We moved from UCLA, from LA to Muncie, bought a nice big house, and the year after we bought it, the house burnt down. So what do? You go to you got to stay at a hotel or wherever. The problem was it was a week before Pesach, and we had nowhere to go. And everyone said, oh, the Bir Chametz, Bir Chametz. Yeah. We laughed at that the first 99 times. Everyone's a chacham. Anyways, so, but we didn't have a place to go. So we called Travelers Insurance, and they said, okay, we'll put you up by Motel 6. And I said, we can't. Pesach is around the corner, and we need a place for Pesach. So they said, okay, what do you need? I said, it's called a Pesach Hotel. So they said to us, great, how much is that going to cost? For a family of 13, or 12 at that time. So I came back and I said, oh, about $20,000 for 8 days. So they literally laughed me off the phone. They like, So what do? So we called up Chaim David Zwiebel, who is the head of the Aguda. And the head of the Aguda calls up Travelers and says, look, I have an organization called the Agudas Israel. We have about 1 million people, give or take. And we just want to know if Travelers Insurance can cater to our constituency. If not, then we may have to look elsewhere. 1 million people, oh my goodness. 5 minutes later, we get a call from Travelers. Wherever you want to go, go. And that was it. So now we got to stay at a Pesach hotel. The problem with that was that we needed a hotel where the rooms were next to each other, and there were no rooms. So what did we do? We called a hotel, Przanski, and he said, look, we could have it, but the only thing is, we'd have to move rooms around. We'll do it on one condition. Do you agree to speak 3-4 times for the hotel? We'd like to advertise you, and then we'll shuffle people around. I said, sure, I'm a rabbi, I like to speak, no problem. So we end up in this gorgeous hotel. So let's all I'm doing right now is I'm connecting dots. I want you to feel this. You're going to love this, okay? So fire in the house. We end up at a hotel. I end up speaking at the hotel. At the end of my speaking, at the end of Pesach, a man comes over to me and he says, you know, I love the way you spoke. I have an organization. Would you mind speaking for my group, Motzei Shabbos? We have a big group. It's Balabatan doing Kiruv. Would you be masking to speak for them in our shul? I said, sure. So, fire in the house, end up at a hotel, and I'm going to speak to this group. Now, during that week, I had this vision of connecting every Jew in the world for Shabbos. This is thekimshabbat.com. It was a thought, hey, why can't we do this? Why can't we? You know, everyone's calling me, hey, you have 100 guests, we have none. Why can't you send us some of your guests? Because I'm not going to be. That's not the way it works. You find your guests, I find my guests. So that was my thought. So, but I had no money for this. The project was a crazy big project, still bigger than I thought it was. So I just figured it's just one of those dreams that'll come and go. I'm speaking in the shul, and in the shul as I'm speaking, I figured, hey, I have a captive audience. Let me just throw it out there. So I tell the shul, by the way, you all want to do Kiruv? What if you were able to create a profile and people were able to find you? That's my vision, to unify all the Jewish people. If anyone's interested, come to me. Right after the speech, this guy, Lee Needleman, comes running over to me and says, Rabbi, can I be your fundraiser? Well, let me think about that one. For free. The fundraiser, yes, you can. You twisted my arm. You'll raise money for it. And thus began. So again, connecting the dots. Fire, hotel, speaking, have the idea. Because I'm in this community, some random guy comes over to me and funds it. Now, There's a lot of ways to branch this off, but I'm going to just take one. You know, it spread, Baruch Hashem, 6,000 people a week get invited to Shabbos through the website in 111 countries. So it's huge. A lot of things happen. More people, by the just for AY scholarship, you guys know what AY is, right? AYSO. More people go to Eretz Yisrael through AY, through Shabbat.com, than any organization in America. Just by the by. I know the numbers. Yeah. More people in the yeshiva using this. But I'm going to trace this using one step. One step. Listen carefully. Now that we had this ability, there was a girl. She signed up for the site. And she came from a country in Europe. And she writes, you know, I don't know anything about Judaism. My mother's Jewish. I would love to be invited for Shabbos. So I wrote back. There's no Jews where she lived. So I said, I want to help you. How can I help you? So she wrote me the following email. I actually have it over here. Okay, and connect these dots, really crazy stuff. So she writes the following. She writes, Dear Rabbi Klatsko, as you can see from my profile, I'm feeling rather lost and detached. My favorite psalm, one which I think they may read at Jewish funerals, is, Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I won't fear evil, for you are with me. I lie awake at night feeling ostracized from my own life and out of place. Have you ever bought a cardboard jigsaw and one piece doesn't fit it into its position properly? You have to manipulate the edges and squash it into an ill-fitting shape in order for it to join edges with every other puzzle piece? That's how I feel. I watched an Orthodox Jewish woman's YouTube video on being afraid once, and she said the only way to combat separation is through connectivity and unity. That she doesn't fear being cut off because she is connected to the unity of all things. And if we could remember this, we'll never be afraid and we'll never be alone. I wish I felt connected to God. I want to speak to God anywhere and everywhere with that heightened sense of holiness that you feel with every step you take. I want a life where family and community are central to the inner workings of life, like the cog teeth inside a clock. I always wish for a Shabbat on a Friday night sundown and Saturday evening sharing challah and pockets of stories and small comforts. I want to slip my prayers between the cracks of the Western Wall and feel cleansed and connected. I feel so out of place and further away from Judaism and God than I ever have before. I feel so out of place, and I'm jealous of other Jewish families that have these things together. Families that are observant and study Torah and pray and have faith. Blind people can't miss a sight they've never seen. So how come I miss a life I've never had with people I've never known? I literally can't sleep from being terrified of life and the obstacles I'm faced with. I'm scared of being alone, never finding happiness, never finding God. You'll have to forgive me if I've said anything off color or out of turn. This is the first time I've ever shared these thoughts with someone, much less a Jewish man. My profile is true to every letter. I can't speak Hebrew. I've never read the Torah, never eaten kosher, never met another Jewish person ever. I guess in a way I've lived an atheist life. My mother's Ashkenazi Jewish parents died, and it goes on to explain that she married an atheist, and a staunch atheist, and he brought the family in a place where there are no Jews, completely atheist. And she says, they're all happy in their atheist ways. She writes, but I am not. Is it normal to want to be closer to God when you've never been interested before? I'm begging you for any advice. I'm too embarrassed to go to synagogue as I know nothing entailed in the worship. I don't know the songs or prayers or blessings. Is it too late for me? Someone told me she always learned to drive a car when you're younger, because the older you get, the harder it is to learn. Should I feel the same about Judaism? And she finishes, ever grateful with kindest regards. I wrote her the following letter back, a short letter. I wrote, I was moved by your sincerity and heartfelt words. Let me assure you, you are not too late in discovering your Judaism. You have nothing to be ashamed of. You were born and grew up under circumstances that didn't allow you to learn and experience the beauty and profundity of your heritage. The fact that it is so meaningful to you with so little background is simply a testament to a brilliant spark that rests deep within you, that refuses to be darkened and extinguished. I promise you that I will do all I can to help you fan that spark. Allow it to burst into a warm and cozy flame that will help you see clearly in daytime and sleep peacefully at night. Just don't give up. Although we are far apart, we will be kindred spirits. You have my word and my encouragement. You are no longer lost. You are found. That's what I wrote to this girl who found the site that was paid for by the person who was in the shul where I spoke, because I was in the hotel because our house burned down. I ended up Skyping with this girl, and ultimately, we offered her to go to Jewel to meet Jews for the first time in her life. She said she didn't know if she can go because her family has a vacation to Greece planned, and Jewel wouldn't take her in the middle, so she had a choice to make. She chose to go to Jewel, give up her family vacation. She goes to Jewel, and a few days after she arrives, she got very sick, and she ended up in the hospital. She had a miserable time, and I thought, this is it. She wanted to go home. El Al wouldn't take her on the plane because she was contagious. They were afraid she was contagious. Instead, she ended up by a family, and the family took such good care of this girl. The chesed that she witnessed was more powerful than anything that Jewel had to offer. They made Havdalah by her bedside, and when she finally got better and she was bowled over by this community, she never met Jews, and look how kind they are. At the end, she gets the bill. The bill from the hospital was over $2,000. She said, what am I supposed to do? I can't pay this. So the Rebbetzin said, give me a few minutes. The Rebbetzin comes back and says, it's all paid for. She says, I don't understand. What does that mean? It's all paid for. I told a few people in the community your situation, and they paid your bill. She broke down crying. She said, where do you meet such people? This is amazing. So rather than run back to Europe, she ended up staying, and she went to Neve. And I did a trip in the winter, and she was my madricha. First time I ever met her, actually. Then, because of visa issues, she had to leave. And because she had to leave, I figured, oh, Yvay, she's going to leave, she'll go back to Europe, and that'll be it. So I told her, why don't you come to our home in Muncie? Pesach is coming. You've never experienced Pesach. Come to us. She said, I'd love to. Little did we know that her family has no money. So she took all of her earthly possessions. She was a photographer. She took her cameras and all her equipment and all of her clothing and put them for sale on eBay so she could pay for a ticket so she could end up experiencing her Pesach. And from there she grew. And from there she ended up going back to Neve to learn. And she was my madrika this summer. Now let's finish connecting the dots. House burns down, end up in a hotel, end up speaking for a shul, a dream gets paid for, some girl that never met a Jew but his parent or mother was Jewish, ends up coming, finding it, ends up coming to Eretz Israel, difficult times, ends up staying, ends up being a madricha on a trip, discovering her love for Judaism. And the last dot to connect is that she just got married a few weeks ago to a Ben Torah, Yiddish guy, a Frum guy, my son.
Oh my gosh.
Now we have connected the dots. Be well, everyone. Have a great day. Her name is Gemma, by the way. Oh, if you want to see a picture of them together?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Of course.
Chris, here is...
Cheers,
Eric. Yitzi and Gemma. Actually, here. A second. Here. I just turned it off.
Did her family come to the wedding?
Oh, wow.
Okay, they're gorgeous.
Beautiful.
She's 21.
How old is she when she arrived?
She was originally, I think, 19 or 20.
Where
can
we see it again?
Yeah, here.
Wow. Oh, thank you so much.
Actually, you want to see one? We'll show you one more picture. This is worth seeing.
This thank you very much.
A Hasana picture.
Hope come back again.
Wow, that is amazing. She's taller than
him? Wow.
Yes, about 3 inches. And he's learning Kol, and she's supporting him. She now works for Shabbat.com. She's the one who filters all of our hosts to make sure they're good hosts. And she also works for my Akiva trip interviewing. And she's...
She was so sick, this kid. At one point,
she worked in Jules.
She was in Jules. I still go back to the house because she was working in Jules. I found her on the floor in my bathroom, unable to like stand up. Just like,
she's missed the whole program. Like, it's like, Julie, never had a
I'm going to get my daughter. I'll meet you at the
front. She was so overwhelmed by the Majachot and the Pia.
Oh my god.
Wow. Such a good story.
Seeing Pia Pasta.
Okay.
Okay.
That's
incredible. Wow. Thank you. You're
Yes, there's like more praise. I didn't get a chance to see you when you came. I was at home with the kids, but thank you so much for coming.
Did it help at all?
Yeah, I mean, it was good. So. I mean, like, we definitely still have, like, students that we still, like, need to get in touch with from, like, that we've recruited, of course, Tracy, but...
He looks like he's a natural, and I hope you're able to survive. Penn State's a golden campus.
Yeah.
It really is. Good kids.
We're loving what we had, and, like, I'm so sad, like, so Hannah Goldberg was on your trip.
Yeah, she's going to JSL.
She's going to JSL, but then she's abroad on the next semester, which is, like, a bit of a bummer. I'm like,
I know. But she's young still.
She is great, and you mentioned that she's not in a room.
I know. I told Jackie about it. Hopefully Jackie's going to...
Right, we're having 3 students on JSL. So that's amazing. We're also...
What's that? The other two are going in the summer, right? Who's Shayna?
Shayna is not going on JSL.
Who else?
Allison Connors and
Hunter Moss. And Hunter Moss, that's right, that's right.
And we've actually come up with our own idea of how to change the world.
Okay.
And we want to create something called Who'd You Know? And an app that would basically kind of take the idea that you've done and kind of do like Jewish geography
I'm gonna call you.
And
I'm
do a bit more of inside, like, more connection, more connectivity. And we're still working on it. Allison said, like, hey, she's like randomly texting me. She's already gone back home to Florida. And my parents are interested in potentially hunting it.
Wow.
Or fundraising for it or something. So I don't know. So we're going to see. But anyway.
This is where I just came. I just kept her husband in
Texas. Yeah. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. You met my wife?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Hi, I love you. Did you have fun in school? I'm coming home tonight.
Yeah.
You're both like that.
Yeah. I want to find the lady who can give us a drive. Okay. Kim, I love you.
Who are you?
That was so great. Thank you.
You knew the ending. Right?
I knew the ending, but I didn't know the beginning. So
now you connected to that.
I was able to connect to that. But you know what? We don't always get to connect to that.
That's true.
But you have to believe that there are that.
100%.
100%.
I mean,